for your contribution. And now, it is my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker, Julie from Visalia. She's got 2.5 years, her sobriety date is February 17th of 2011. And her favorite little motto here is trust God, clean house, and trust us, help others. She's been a secretary, and she's also done H&I work, which she loves. So everybody give a warm welcome to Julie!
Julie, I'm an alcoholic. Thank you for letting me come here and speak tonight. That means that I get to be sober today and pick it up again tomorrow. I did a lot of praying and I didn't prepare anything to talk, but I want to share with you that I started drinking when I was 14. Just turned 14, but I think I got to get born with that irritable, discontented, angry outlook. I was born with that. My dad had that. And so as a kid, if I was always wanting what somebody else had, or I was giving my friends report cards after we had play dates, that worked out really well. They didn't come back, so I didn't have to share. And I remember we were down in Mexico, and my parents thought it would be a great idea if these two men in their 20s took me out for the evening. I just turned 14. And I had some rum and coke, and it was amazing. I felt so, it made me feel comfortable, that kind of, I always felt like I didn't fit in, you know, like if you wear glasses when you get them in the fourth grade and now you're different. I always felt different and like I wasn't part of the popular group. I was just kind of always on the outside. And I know people say that we have special brains. And I bought that for a while because I like to be special. But I've decided lately that what it is staying immature and selfish and self-centered and not growing up. And alcohol let me ignore all those uncomfortable feelings that people who grow up work through in their teens. And I felt easy and I could talk and I was funny. And it was great. But as a young teen, my parents' experiment with letting me go out with older men in Mexico didn't work out very well for me. And so I spent my teenage years basically trying to self-destruct. I partied. I used anything I could get my hands on. I drank consistently. I was miserable. And so I tried to kill myself twice, the serious kind where you don't leave the note. You just do it. And that was really kind of a black time for me. And then as I guess I went, got out of high school and realized I was going to be continuing on, and it turned into a party time. The party was on. Where were we? Are we in the 70s? Yeah. And I had a great time. I drank a lot. I didn't talk to people about what happened to me when I was drinking like that. So I'm from L.A. originally. Driving across L.A. in a blackout and waking up, you know, and I'm across town and having absolutely no idea how I got there and thinking, oh, my God, I never talked about that. I think it was normal for the people I knew to party like that. And I just didn't worry about it. So I had those blackout periods. and I continued to have a good time. And then as I got older, I decided I wanted to fit in more. I wanted to get more mainstream. So I dropped off the other stuff I was doing besides alcohol, because alcohol is legal. And I just stuck to alcohol then. And I kind of mellowed out. And now I realized it was a lot of white knuckle, controlled drinking. But I was still not comfortable in my skin. I was kind of relentlessly unhappy. And I look back now on what I had or the friends I had, and it's just amazing, because today I have a lot less and I'm so much happier because I'm sober. So I look back on that and realize that I was really unhappy with myself and who I was, and we talked about it the other night, and I said I was small, petty, mean, and hateful. And that was pretty much how I felt most of the time, unless I was drinking and we were partying and that was fun. I stopped drinking for about 4 or 5 years because I got married, and my husband, very smart, creative man who had a lot of addictive behavior. So we decided that he was an alcoholic and I would not drink to support him. And what I did before then, and again, I never told anybody, because why would I tell anyone? Thank you. Is I tried some of that controlled drinking experiment at home, where I'd say, okay, I'm just going to have 2 glasses of wine. And he'd go to bed, and I'd be on my 2nd glass, and then I'd be on my 3rd glass, and then I'd be on my 4th glass. And the thing with wine is it makes me sick. I can't drink wine all night. It just didn't work for me very well. But I realized I couldn't stop. And I had girlfriends like that. You know, we'd get the big bottle of wine and we'd finish one every night. I just couldn't stop if I still had alcohol. So I stopped drinking to support my husband. And I kind of knew I had a problem, but I wasn't willing to admit it. And then I picked that up again a couple years later. And I went back to wine because, again, I have to stop after a certain point or I'm just going to get sick. I can't do that. But I started branching out and I started partying more. And so now I'm in my 40s and maybe not everything's working out the way I want it to. And I'm pissed off at my 2nd husband. So I married really fast after the 1st divorce. And we were living up in a log house up in the mountains on about 160 acres, 3 miles in from the highway. And I'd drive down to work 3 days a week. And the rest of the time I was up. And it was just beautiful. But there was a lot of partying up there. And there's that saying, you know, wherever you go, there you are. And I kept thinking, maybe if I changed where I lived. I didn't want to live in Visalia, and I didn't want to live in that nice house I built with my husband. So I'll go live in a log cabin with this nice man who may have been a good husband to somebody else, but it didn't work out very well for me. And he thought I had a problem drinking. And it pissed me off because I didn't drink in the morning and I didn't drive and drink because I'm a lawyer and I know what happens when you drive and drink, and it's so expensive and it's so bad. So I couldn't be an alcoholic because I wasn't doing that stuff, and I wasn't drinking vodka or I wasn't drinking hard liquor, you know, I was just drinking wine, you know. So I ended up getting really, really pissed off at him. And at the same time, I started hanging out with people who were even more hardcore. And I got introduced to whiskey. And God, it was like falling in love. You know, I can't be around it. I can't smell it. I can't really talk about it. At one point in early sobriety, I had a fantasy about, like, decorating one room with, you know, Jim Beam mirrors and Chivas clocks, and realized that was probably a really bad idea. But I wanted to for a while. And my daughter had one of those bags that Chivas comes in, the little blue velvet bag with the gold cord, and I couldn't stand it. She was, like, keeping special stuff in it. And I think I finally took it and I threw it away one day, and I didn't tell her. I didn't want to look at it. But I started drinking whiskey, and it was on. I could drink that all night. I didn't get sick. I drank it until I couldn't walk anymore, and I decided it would be a good idea to, like, put a nuclear bomb into my life, and I blew up my marriage by hooking up with someone very publicly in the little community where we are, and people were, like, running around with pitchforks and flaming torches, and somebody made me a t-shirt with the letter A on it, and I was sneaking around on the back roads, you know, but it was on, and it was like I finally went totally crazy. So I drank for 36 years, but it was like the last five, I just went nuts. And I drank more than I've ever drunk in my life, and I drank every opportunity I could, and I was erratic, and you know, the only thing, I held on to my job, and in a way that time, my job and my daughter saved me. I think if I hadn't had my daughter, I wouldn't be here today, because I wouldn't have cared enough to live. And I knew that if I blew it with my job, that would be like the end. So that was so important to me. I kept up a really good, I was a functioning alcoholic. I had everything at work, I had it down, and nobody had any idea. And then I'd go way back in the mountains, 65 miles away, at about 7,000 feet elevation, and drink and drink and party and carry on and drive around screaming. I mean, the driving drunk kind of went out the window for a while. That didn't count in this community because it was really small. I subjected my daughter to a lot of instability. We moved around a lot. My boyfriend was a four-time DUI Irish drinker. He introduced me to whiskey. He introduced me to half and half, like Irish cream and brandy on the rocks in a big glass. And I was really good at lying to myself, and I'm still really good at that. I can be honest with you, or think I am. I can be honest with my daughter, but I can really lie to myself about what I'm doing or why I'm doing it. So I ended up living in Squaw Valley on 5 acres where I could drink and carry on and nobody would have any idea what I was doing, and driving down to work every day and going back, and deciding that this was somehow good for my daughter who's, you know, moving up in terms of growing up. And that didn't work out very well. And then the economy crashed. And so we ended up coming down to Visalia. And I don't know what you guys are like, but when I was drinking, I always had fantasies about what it was going to be like. And I was going down to Visalia, and I had fantasies about how I was going to have cocktail parties with my girlfriends coming over, and we were going to, like, watch Project Runway, and we were all going to be drinking and having a fun time, and it was going to be really cool. And a year later, and my daughter was getting older, so my drinking was planned. My binging was planned, and I'd get her in bed, and then I'd break out the booze. I was drinking alone, and the phone never rang, and I was drinking till the next day, you know, where you're sick, and you're sweaty, and you feel really bad. And my life, it wasn't going the way I wanted. And the drinking then, you know, when I was a teenager, I was trying to kill myself. When I was in my 20s and 30s, I was partying. But now I was really pissed off, and I had a list, and I had a plan, and I realized that if I kept drinking like this, well, my fantasy was, of course, I was going to go out in a blaze of glory after I killed these people who were on my list. I realized now that what would probably happen is the police would take me into custody after some pathetic attempt at assaulting someone. But either way, I was going to lose my job, I was going to lose my daughter, I was going to lose everything that I worked for, and I was 50. And it was like, I was so miserable. So we have to go to continuing education, mandatory, and we have to go to substance abuse. And it was like a couple days after I planned drinking. I drank everything in the house. I wasn't supposed to go to work the next day, and they called me in. And I was sweaty, and I was sick and shaky, and I can't go to work like that. And I went to, the next day, I went to the seminar, and someone who spoke in here was talking, and I felt like there was a neon sign above me going, she's it! She's the alcoholic! And I said, you know, you got that, oh my God, pick me. I'm looking around, are they looking at me? Can they tell? Because I was sure everyone knew. And so I had the number to call, and I spent about 3 or 4 days. I was not willing to come into these rooms. I realized I had a problem, and I'd reached out occasionally after one binge up in the mountains where I did some things I wasn't supposed to do. I called a friend and said, I have a problem, and somehow her big book ended up in my house. But I don't remember how it got there. And I didn't go to a meeting. And I wasn't willing to go to AA. But I couldn't keep living the way I was living. And it was all like, when I would go out in public, it was all a front. It was all a mask. And if I hadn't had my daughter, I probably would have killed myself because there was just no point. So I'd walk the dog for miles and dial the number and hang up. And dial the number and hang up. And I did that for a couple of days, crying. And I finally told someone I had a problem. And I finally, the call went through and I got hooked up to someone here and I said, yeah, I have a problem, but I'm not going to AA. And he's like, yeah, that's fine. And sure, you know, whatever, because he knows darn well that's where I'm going. Because part of the problem, too, was I thought that there was something really seriously wrong with me, and there was, but I thought nobody else had it. I thought I was crazy, and I kind of was, but I didn't think anybody else experienced what I was experiencing, like, you know, dealing with my emotions by drinking, because if I let them out, I wasn't going to come back. I thought I'd go out of control. I was so afraid, and I thought I was totally alone. And I went into these rooms. I think this was the first meeting I went to, and it just scared the shit out of me. I mean, you know, when you're new and you're coming in and you're sweaty and you're shaky and you're crazy and you're, you know, your brain's just flying around in there. And it took me a while to calm down enough to listen, and I started listening, and I heard my story. And the cool thing was, is it's one thing to, like, you're sitting in a room with women, and somebody who looks like you tells your story, and that was a great relief. But as I kept getting sober, I remember sitting in a room with and listening to a guy who rides a motorcycle and is a hard ass, and he told my story, and his words stuck in my head for weeks after that, and it was such a relief to realize I'm not alone. We're part of the secret club now, where we can, like, walk around with each other in the supermarket and go, hi. It's so cool. So I heard my story, and I realized I wasn't alone, and that was a huge relief. And I came in voluntarily knowing that if I didn't, something really bad was going to happen. It was just coming. And I could see people with peace, and they were happy. Remember that? You come in, you're brand new, and people are happy, and it's like, I didn't think you were lying. I just didn't have any idea how I would get to that place. It seemed so far away from where I was, but I wanted it. So I got a sponsor. Actually, I asked someone to be a sponsor, and then I went, like, postal on her before we even had our first meeting, and she handed me over to somebody else. She didn't have enough time for me to spend with me. And she's a good friend now, but I was crazy. And it was like the fear and my ego were the only thing that was holding me together, and everything else was broken. And I got a sponsor, and I wanted what you had when I went to your meetings, and I listened to you, and I did what my sponsor told me to, and I worked the steps. And, you know, I've been miserable for 30 years. Maybe I had a couple of good years in there, so let's say 25 to 30 years. And I've gone looking for help. But working those steps made more of a difference than the years and years and years of counseling I went to trying to fix what was broken. I knew something was wrong. I didn't know how to fix it. I thought they could help me fix it. And it never worked. And they're so simple, but they are so hard. And the memory's fading, but there are people here who remember me from going to the Saturday women's meeting, and I just went in there and I just sobbed and cried for months. When I realized that, and really my job and my daughter held me together, because I didn't think I had any right to breathe the air on this planet. I had somehow grown up and gotten the message that I was worthless. And no matter what good grades I got or how well I did or what I ended up doing for a living, it was never good enough. My mom was really disappointed I didn't marry a doctor or a lawyer. And I said, it's not good enough for you that I'm a lawyer, is it? And it wasn't. And she's not a bad person. I love her. But that was her generation. That was the pinnacle of achievement. You're supposed to go out and marry that. And that was where you got your self-worth from. And so I was empty when I came to AA, or I was even on a negative, because I realized I had spent most of my life numbing the feelings because I didn't feel that I had any right to be here. I had no right to be happy. I had no right to experience love or true friendship. And And so for me that was good because I started from nothing. And I'd never learned what it was like to have a friend sober or to be in a relationship sober. And I still don't know what that's like, and I probably won't, but that's okay. I didn't know how to be a mom sober. And for you guys who can still have kids and raise kids who are in here, congratulations for being here, because there's no way I would have shown up unless it was on a court card. There's no way I would have come in here young and said I had a problem. I wouldn't do it. I had too much ego and too much fear. And so I got to come in here while my daughter was a teenager and start making a living amends to her and sharing my program with her, but I didn't get to raise her sober. And that is a regret. And I know it says we will not have regrets about the past. We will not forget the past. But the fact is, you know, now that I've been sober for 2.5 years, it's a pretty cool thing. So the first year was a bitch. It was really hard. And when I came in, I thought there were things I wanted. You know, we come in. I don't know what it's like for you, but for me, I was desperately lonely, and I thought what I wanted more than anything was to be in a relationship with a man. And I was crazy. I was not sober, I wasn't thinking straight, and I had this incredible, that's what I thought I wanted. I'd go to meetings and cry about it. I don't want to be in a relationship. But my sponsor told me don't do it. Go through the steps, work the steps, spend your first year getting to know yourself. And the cool thing was, is as I worked the steps, about the 6th or 7th month, I woke up one day and realized that that had gone away. And instead of an empty place, I was starting to experience some peace. And I hadn't had that. There's a section in the big book that talks about what it's like for people who lost faith versus people who'd never had it. And I grew up going to church on Sundays. And I thought I had faith. I definitely have lost it. I was cynical about it. I'm not going to go into religion. But the idea of recognizing that I wasn't in control anymore, and I spent my life thinking that I actually could control things like my ex-husband dealing with my daughter or how my husband was treating me or whatever. I thought I could control that if I just changed my behavior. And to go through the steps and realize that I only have control over what's going on in my head and what comes out of my mouth was such a relief. Oh my God, I could just let the rest of that go. And I'd done damage. I have wreckage in my past. But it was such a relief to get that monkey off my back, thinking that it was my responsibility to try to make stuff happen. And the freedom of getting to have a higher power in my life of my understanding. And so I don't have to be of a certain religion. And if I'm not, then I'm excluded. I get to just have my higher power work through my life. And for me, it's when I go to meetings and you share that I hear my higher power talking to me and telling me what I need to hear. I always hear something that speaks to me. And so after that first year, as I continued in sobriety, I was really open with my daughter about it. I also told my work about it because I wanted accountability. I knew if I kept the fact that I had a problem with secret, I could go back to it more easily. Work said they had no idea, but I've changed in how I deal with people because it isn't about ego or protecting something anymore, and I can actually achieve moments of connection and kindness now. And I shared it with my daughter, and I'm pretty sure that the whole time that she was growing up, I was pretty much a raving bitch. And she were here, she would tell you that that's true. There were perhaps moments where we had fun, but I was pretty wound up. And I worked through the steps. I was transparent with her about it. She got to see me cry a lot. She got to see me make amends with various people. She got to see me go to meetings and get sober. And our house changed. And all the pressure that was on her to perform or to not piss off mom. And I guess she used to break down and cry at school, like when she got a bad grade, because of what I was going to do when she got home. And I can just be grateful that for the last couple years of her being in my house, we've gotten to heal. And through that whole period, because you know what, her dad's an alcoholic too, and it was like she's got no chance. And I'd say, so, you know, if you find yourself thinking stuff that's kind of out of control, if you get really pissed off, because that's what we're good at, is getting really pissed off and you can't control it, I can get you to a meeting where you can talk to people and I won't be there. And I tell her that every couple of months, 3-4 months. She's like, yeah, mom, whatever. And she's been going to Alateen now for over a year. And I'm just so grateful about that because at her age, I had already, you know, I'd run away from home. I hitchhiked across the U.S. I was using all kinds of drugs and alcohol. I tried to kill myself. I was a miserable human being. And here's my daughter's kind of been spared that because our higher powers worked in our life to let me be honest with her and her see it work. Because what I tell people I know who have kids is, you know, we all talk all kinds of crap and then we do something else. And our kids are watching us. They're not watching what we say, they're watching what we do. And so she got to watch the miracle happen and the promises come true in her life. And I don't mean to like start crying like a baby, but I am so grateful for that. I realize she's going to go to college and all hell could break loose. And I have no control over that. And I know that too. God, that's so hard. But for anyone who's new in sobriety, don't leave until the miracle happens, because it will. You've got to get a sponsor. You need to do what they ask you to do and go to meetings, work the steps. They're really simple, but they're so powerful. And they've let me walk through my dad's death sober. And I didn't think I'd ever be able to do that, but my dad got sick totally unexpectedly last December and he passed. And it let me walk through that with my sister, who's active in this disease. And it let me love her and let her be. And the old person would have been trying to finagle a way to change her behavior and get her to see what was going on with her. And I know I have no control over anything. And the best thing I can do is just love her. And I talk about my program and the steps because that's how I live my life now. That's how I relate to being sane. And I still can go crazy and I have. And that's when I forget and I don't fall back on all those slogans. I think I just need a solid sleeve. Let go and let God. Trust God. My favorite slogan was something a friend says, trust God, clean house, and help others. Most days, I don't get past trust God. You know, I'm really good at trusting God when things are going well. When they're not going my way, it's a lot harder. And then all day, it's just kind of trust God. Remember, you're supposed to trust God. And I'll forget. I have a lot of years of trying to do things my way. So more often than not, I'll be trying to impose my will, and it doesn't work. And at some point, there'll be enough barriers thrown up that I'll remember, right, it's not your show, and I can let that go. So don't wait till the miracle happens, because it will, and being sober is great. It's a heck of a lot better than all the great partying that I remember. And you get to remember what you did the next day, and you don't have to try to remember what you said to people. That's all I've got. I'm Julie. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you.